You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Shade, and this is The View. We're delighted to have you with us today. We're going to be talking with some very interesting guests. Meg is under the weather, but she was our guests today are the Reverend David Breeden, who is the senior minister at the First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis, and Kevin Jago, who is the director of, he is the director of youth director at First Unitarian Society, and he is the director in marketing and development at the Humanist Institute. And Meg will be happy to know, if she doesn't already, that he's an incoming fellow at the Church of the Larger Fellowship next year, and he's a student at Meadville Lombard. Hello, David. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Well, first question, why don't you tell us what humanism is in case there's people out there who are a little unclear or who have misconceptions about it?
My working definition of humanism is that humanism is an evidence-based value system dedicated to saving or helping the human flourish and saving the planet. The next question usually is, are you all atheists? And I say no. For one thing, it's evidence-based, so as soon as we find some evidence for a God, we're there. It's a no-brainer from that point. A lot of us haven't seen that, so some of us are atheists or agnostics. But we try to be what I call a religion-neutral zone here. We don't talk about religion in the congregation on Sundays, so... We don't denigrate religion, we just don't talk about it.
Mm. Kevin, how does that work with youth?
Yeah, well, one thing that I would add on to David's definition is that one thing that we've talked about at First Unitarian Society on Sunday mornings and in the youth program here is that what First Unitarian Society has been putting out into the world for a very long time and has been kind of rearticulated by David more recently is that we're proposing this radical notion that human effort is enough to solve human problems. And I believe David actually coined that phrase himself. So this idea with our youth program here is we're looking at what does it mean to be a humanist and a UU? Are we, and are the youth both or neither? You know, because that's an open question in our youth program, is are they Unitarian Universalists? As they've come up, you know, we in our program are really open-minded about here's all we do a very similar program in religious education around things like neighboring faiths, OWL, these are credo writing in our coming of age program. So it's this idea like here are many, many traditions. Now it's up to you to choose as you become a teenager and a youth here at FUS. And what happens is most of our youth identify as humanists, and most of our youth identify as Unitarian Universalists, but not all, and that's okay. So in our youth program, it's really about what are we doing here to equip our youth with the tools that they need to find community after they graduate from our program, because while some of them might still be in the Twin Cities and have First Unitarian Society here locally, many won't. Many go off to college elsewhere. So this idea of how are they evaluating communities, what's most important to them? Is it that it's any community that says they are Unitarian Universalist and that's what's most important to them? And what the theological mix of that community isn't as important? Or is it that they're looking for a non-theistic community and it's great if it's also UU? And I think that some of our youth balance that differently. And we've talked about that, how First Unitarian Society is, in the nation, a relatively unique place. So the idea that they're going to find a place just like ours around the corner is not going to happen. So it's more about what aspects of First Unitarian Society are most important to them and their identity. Is it that they don't talk about God, or is it that they are UU, and are they really trying to find that place where they can be both fully?
Mm-hmm. Right. We should mention that, I'm getting it. We should mention that the Twin Cities is very unique in UUism in general, in that we have several large congregations, and many of them have kept their unique historical past. So we became humanist in 1916 when John Dietrich was called as the minister. He was already calling himself humanist, and they immediately took up that title when he arrived at this congregation. We've always been humanist. First Universalist has pretty well stuck with the Universalist message. Unity over in St. Paul is very much an old-line Unitarian theistic congregation. So we have some interesting variety, and I think actually that makes us even more rich in terms of getting more people interested in Unitarian Universalism, because we have such variety here.
So it sounds like, rather than having kind of a big tent approach, which happens in many churches, mm-hmm. each church can really specialize and kind of stake out their territory.
Yeah. Well, you realize that in 1961, at the merger, First Universalist and First Unitarian are a 10-minute drive apart. So if they hadn't stayed different, there wouldn't be any reason for two of them to have stayed in existence, basically. So
it may have been a 10-minute drive then. I think it's longer now, isn't it?
It's according to Sunday morning.
Okay.
And that's something that is a unique aspect here in Minneapolis anyways, is I know people that worship at both on Sunday.
Yeah. Mm.
They will go to one service at one and then one service at the other, or coffee hour at one. You know, so people are building an experience in the Twin Cities that I think you can't really find in many other places in the world as well, where you can come and hear a humanist service and then go down the road and hear a very universalist service and chat with people at both of those, in both of those communities.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And can I just, having grown up in a very humanist congregation, and Kevin, your description sounds fantastic, and being able to be really sort of honest with our young folks as they head out to college is just so important, and I think that doesn't often happen. That you know, being able to sort of say what's most important to you in your own needs, being able to sort of say, do you need a humanist situation? Do you need a UU situation? You know, that's so great. And I'm gonna tell, if folks will indulge me, a brief story. Just 2 weeks ago, Farley Wheelwright, who was one of my ministers growing up, passed away at age of 99. Farley, a staunch atheist, and years later, when I was in seminary, he said, "Come over to my house. I'm going to give you some books." So I was over there, and he starts complaining about like all the secret cabal of Christians who are running the UU way. It's going on and on. And I turned to him and I said, "You know, Farley, I believe in God." And Farley slowly turned towards me and he went, "Where did we go wrong?"
An indictment of the New Bedford Religious Education Department there.
Well, I have a question from a viewer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
What kind of rituals are embraced in humanist-focused congregations?
Well, that's an interesting question. I often hear, "Oh, you humanists don't have any rituals," but of course, we have been doing this since 1916. God has not appeared in any ritual or liturgy here, except as kind of an accident in a hymn sometimes. So we basically, I mean, I have often argued that if you set a camera up and didn't turn the sound on, that you would think you were in a Methodist church, probably. Unlike the Ethical Society, we developed out of Protestantism. They developed out of the Jewish tradition, but we developed out of Protestantism. So we've always had a sort of low church Protestant way of doing things. I grew up in a Pentecostal church when I was a kid. You know, we didn't have any candles, we didn't have any crosses, we didn't have any symbols whatsoever, because all of that was considered to be a product of the Antichrist. And so we're very much like that here. We just the chalice is the only thing that we have that could be identified as being in any way religious. And we do the same thing in our rituals or liturgy. You know, we're about breaking down hierarchy, we're about freedom, and we're about getting together to create the community that we see as equal and, you know, and just. So that's what we try to do, is break it down.
Follow-up question, what do you do at Christmas and, you know, a big holiday like that?
Well, we ignore Easter. We did our big celebration last Sunday, in which I talked about Persephone and the Eloisian mysteries. We celebrate pagan holidays basically. But Kevin, you did Christmas Eve. We have 50 people show up at Christmas Eve service.
To loop back to the rituals question, I would say though, well, if you turn off the camera, you wouldn't see a difference necessarily in what we do. We do hit all of the major rituals that any UU congregation would. So mm-hmm. we have a coming of age service for our youth. We have baby welcomings. We have, you know, weddings happen here frequently. Mm-hmm. Memorials happen here all the time. So all of those major rituals of the cycle of life happen here, just without God being invoked most of the time if they're coming here. Once again, because you have that specialist congregation in us, you know, if you wanted something else, there are plenty of options, both within Unitarian Universalism and beyond, right in our neighborhood. There's churches below. So there's other places that you could go if you wanted that. So people self-select here because they want what we are offering. And then what was the follow-up question? I've lost it. I had something.
Christmas Eve. What you did on Christmas Eve.
Yes, Christmas Eve. So I ran our Christmas Eve service, which was a lot of fun. I've been acting as kind of the baby intern this year because we don't have a ministerial intern. So I've got some of our extra services, and it's something that we still celebrate, but it's our smallest service of the entire year, which is very different than other congregations. So it reflects our culture here in that it's not the most important time of year for us as a community. However, the winter solstice is our biggest service a few nights earlier. Yep. So people have voted with their feet about what they want. But what we do is we sing carols. I did a short, less than 10-minute reflection about kind of what this community means to me, to kind of have it be uplifting and kind of about how great we are. You know, I wanted it to be about that and have the people that came there. We did hot cocoa, cookies, St. Carol's, and we were done in about 45 minutes and people went home. You know, it's a very small thing, but for those 50 to 60 people, some of them have been doing that for almost a decade. So there's still a tradition there, but it's a small one, and it's definitely not the highlight of the year for most people here.
Mm-hmm. I attended Sunday services on December 27th or 28th, a long time ago, at the First Unitarian Society, back when the Reverend Kendall Gibbons was the minister there. And it was December 27th, and there was not anywhere in the building that I could see any sign of the Christmas holiday. Not a picture of not even a picture of Santa Claus, or you know, even any of the secular manifestations of the Christmas holiday. It was like any Sunday in January. It was kind of striking to me, but there it was. You know, that's so they are right. I can imagine their Christmas Eve service being the smallest of the year for them. Yes,
but I will say the building is pretty. Gussied up in Christmas decorations.
Greenery.
I think we're just really efficient.
Oh, okay.
Hide all the evidence.
Yeah. But for the lead up of that month, there's
all right. Okay.
There's pine. There's lights. We have, I think, two or three Christmas trees.
Yeah. Yes. We just point out that, of course, the Christmas tree is actually a pagan symbol.
So. Right.
Well, yes. Yeah, everybody knows that.
David, you use the term religion neutral, that mm-hmm. the society is religion neutral on Sunday. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, we just don't talk about it. Once in a while, I'll talk about my past. For example, I was raised Pentecostal, and I'm not anti-Pentecostalism. All of my family still are Pentecostals. I understand it. It's just not for me. Most of the people who come to us, what happened to them is they just stopped believing. And as you know, belief is not something you can force. So most people come to us out of integrity because they no longer believe what they grew up with or what they have to say with the creeds on Sunday morning. And so those are the people we attract. So they don't want to hear about it, frankly. They see it as an oppressive force, and they just don't want to talk about it.
Well, I wanted to ask you just a little side. The other question is the Humanist Institute. Mm-hmm. What's that? Tell us about that.
Well, Kevin, you've been doing it a lot longer. Well, Kevin is a graduate, so why don't you talk about it first, and then I'll talk about what we're doing now.
So, yes, the Humanist Institute, for me, was a part of my discernment process to go to seminary. That's not true of many of our graduates that go there, but what the Humanist Institute started off as was big tent humanism in the form of a graduate program to train leaders for the humanist movement, and really meant from Unitarian Universalist humanists, humanistic Jews, and ethical culture sorts of folks to the secular humanists, atheists sorts of folks that were leading nonprofits. And this idea that a lot in the early 80s, a lot of the founders of some of these traditions or some of the people that were leading them that day were looking around the table and not knowing where their successors were going to come. Like, who's gonna lead the American Humanist Association next? You know, for a long time, the answer was Unitarian ministers, but they were having a harder time identifying the mm-hmm. next round of leaders. So the idea was, well, we've got to train them. So that's kind of was the birth point of the Humanist Institute, and today it's a center for humanist education across kind of the spectrum, from lay leaders, people that volunteer on boards, to people that want to be professional humanist leaders in some way, shape, or form. And my experience was of an almost 3-year-long program that was humanist studies and leadership at the graduate level, and it's a cohort model where you work with the same, at that time, you worked with the same folks throughout the entire program, so you got to know those people really well over the course of that time, and it's a small group, so you have lots of time to share about what you're wrestling with, and you kind of come out of it in a different place than you went in. I went in as a humanist and new UU that was not entirely sure how these two things fit together for me, and I came out really sure about that, but also much more broadened, I think, my definition of humanism, because we have people that come in as staunch atheists and are like, I'm not sure if I'm even a humanist, to people that are very open in terms of religious language, and we're all in a room together time and time again talking this out and trying to figure out who we are and what do we want the communities we work with to be and represent, how they represent humanism in the world.
Right. Well, and we should point out that the American Humanist Association does differentiate between humanists and atheists, in that atheists are anti-something, and humanists are for something. So humanism is a moral commitment to bettering humanity and saving the earth. Atheism is about being against God, which seems a little bit pointless to me, but I don't see why one wants to do that. We've been watching the Pew numbers that now about 25% of Americans are nuns, and they're nuns all the way from New Age craziness to whatever. But the new Pew report that just came out says that by 2050, one-third of Americans are going to be nuns. So a much higher percentage, so 1 in 3. And what are they going to do? Are they going to stay home and play video games and order pizza, or are they going to get out there and make sandwiches for the homeless and try to improve the world? And so what? Just because someone becomes an atheist, that doesn't make me happy. I don't sit around being all Schadenfreude about that. It's the question of how do people find moral commitments after they no longer believe in the average established religion.
Have you found that the new atheist writers, are they affecting your society in any way? You know, are you getting visitors who are reading those books and coming in?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, they were very outspoken. I mean, I think that Penn of Penn & Teller is probably one of our greatest evangelists, because people like magic. His book, Every Day is an Atheist Holiday, and that kind of that which is a bit more positive than the Dawkins thing. And I think most people are pretty tired of the four horsemen of new atheism, actually, at this point. So,
and I would say, especially in younger folks, millennials and our teens, are not about necessarily disparaging people that believe in God or gods. You know, like, that's something that I think is really lost purchase for a lot of younger folks. They're just like that, like, yelling at people is not something that really I want to spend a lot of time doing,
right?
Or any time, frankly. But, you know, this idea that our whole movement is based on proving the other wrong doesn't work for younger people. And that our point here, and the purpose of being a humanist, is to do something, right? Is to do something good or build something, because if you actually believe that your life, this one life is your one shot, well, then this is what we have to work with. We have however many days we have, and it's time to do something with that. So a lot of, especially people in my peer group of millennials, are about making meaning out of life and making an impact. Those are kind of the two things that I hear most consistently. And going around trying to disprove other people's belief systems doesn't get a lot accomplished.
No. I mean, one of the most popular blog posts in our movement right now is Hemant Mehta, and he calls it the friendly atheist. He's a younger guy, a person of color. And that's really what's happening in humanism now, is it's swinging much younger, much more positive. And there's a lot of people out there. Bart Campolo is another one. His father, Tony, was a liberal Christian. He is still alive. And Bart was well on his way to being the prince and heir apparent of his father's empire, until he said, wait a minute, I don't believe in God anymore. And then he said, wait a minute, that's an anti. I'm gonna be a humanist, and I'm going to talk positively about what you can do after you stop believing.
Have you seen a difference in anti-Islamic? This is one of the interesting and concerning things that I've seen in atheism, or at least down here in tech, well, in a lot of areas, and that is this kind of unholy alliance between fundamentalist Christians and, using the word very specifically, atheists. Mm-hmm. This anti-Islam thing. Are you seeing any of that in humanism, or is that kind of a dividing line between humanism and atheism?
That's a basic dividing line. I mean, one of our students in the Humanist Institute, I was doing that last weekend, and we went to a masjid as a class, and one of our people who lives in New York City and was much more involved in the atheist side of things and then came to the Humanist Institute, she came away from that experience with the imam saying, wait a minute, I think I've been wrong about this. So, you know, yeah.
It seems to me that the specific question that you are working with in terms of youth is the development of moral agency, a sense that, you know, what you do matters, that you actually have that power to do something, which is, in many ways, no matter what religious tradition you're working from or what religious language you're working from, is the evangelical purpose, aside from building up membership numbers, is reaching people, saying you can have a purpose in your life and make meaning out of your life, and in many ways you have to step out of the pizza and video games life into a larger life. So as you work with youth, is that something you persuade people? Is that something you inspire people, call people? How does that work?
Well, one, it happens with a lot of pizza, still.
So pizza and video games are still part of the plan.
But one thing that I've noticed, at least here at FUS, is that our teens that stick with the program, because in similar to almost every other religious tradition I know, after that coming of age experience, which fulfills for our tradition a lot of what happens at confirmation time. Mm-hmm. Our parents are a lot more apt to let their teens choose whether or not to come on Sunday morning as well. That means we have a drop after that in terms of who comes, which is sad, but what the advantage is those are the kids that definitely want to be there, right? They're the ones that drive themselves here. One of our youth comes, even though her parents no longer come here, she comes, mm-hmm. And she's committed. And one of the things that I think develops that level of commitment is that coming here is a practice. They don't talk about it in terms of it being a practice, but it's something that they have community here that they have nowhere else in their lives. Some of them even go to the same high school, but until we get together in youth group, some of them didn't even realize they were going to the same high school. They're so big. So the idea is that for many of these kids, they've been coming here since they were kindergartners. You know, so once, even though their parents aren't coming very frequently, they're like, this is where I go on Sunday because this is what I do. So some of it is habit and practice. And then I would say the other piece that we do is really develop, what I'm trying to do in the senior high program is develop a toolbox. This idea that wherever you land in the world, you know who you are and find the community that will help you do what you want to do in the world. And that community might be a religious community. I would hope that it is something that at least accomplishes the same things that religious community does, mm-hmm. Or it might not. Mm-hmm. But it's this idea that when we have a small number of kids, especially, and the fact that people are so mobile now, I can't guarantee that they're going to have a community like FUS or even a UU community or I can't guarantee where they're going to land. So I would hate for them to only be able to get what they need here, you know, or to get what they need at a Sunday morning experience. So what we spend a lot of time talking about is what is it that you most value and what is it that you want to do with your life, this one wild ride that many of us believe we have, and what communities are going to help you accomplish that the most and which ones are going to hold you back from doing that. And I think that for people that those answers vary quite a bit. Even in our kind of steady numbers in our senior high program are around 12 kids on Sunday morning. So it's a kind of a small to large group experience. But even in that setting, there's people that have the teens have very different answers to what matters most to them.
You know, one thing we should make clear, because we talk a lot about humanism, is that this congregation has always dedicated itself to staying Unitarian. Mm-hmm. And that's been insistent all the way through time, and part of that is that atheism too is a creed, you know, it is a belief system. So we don't require any creed whatsoever here, and so our religious education program is based on regular Unitarian Universalist curricula. That's what we do. Our DRE is a liberal Christian. She came back to it after having left Protestantism, and now she's a super liberal Catholic at a congregation that could only exist in a place like Minneapolis. It's a heretical Catholic congregation, but we really believe in the UU principle of raising kids to find their own meaning and purpose, whatever that is. We don't preach humanism in our RE program. So.
So what do you think are the prospects of growth of humanism at this point in time?
Our growth has really exploded. One of the things that we're doing here, you know, we are located downtown. We're an urban congregation. So we have a big old building in a high rent district. So what do we do with that? And one of my attempts here has been to watch the numbers, and we know that a lot of congregations are going to go out of business because millennials are not joiners. You're going to have to, if they give 10% of the money that a boomer gives, then you got to have 10 times as many people in the future, and that's not likely. So what do you do? Well, what we do is we invite as many humanist groups into this building to use it as we can. The Sunday Assemblies group, which is advertises the Atheist Church, we give them our space rent free. We also house the Humanists of Minnesota, which are the people who don't believe in going to a congregation in terms of congregational humanism. They want a lecture and they want lunch, and that's about all they want out of being a humanist. So we house those, and so if you Google humanism in Twin Cities, we happen to house all of the humanist groups in the Twin Cities. So, and that's one of our goals is to, you know, I would love, looking at the number of Protestant churches there are scattered around, what if there were that number of humanist churches, all different, you know, different denominational styles, et cetera. And that's kind of my vision for the future. I hope that does happen someday. But, you know, one of the things we're seeing in black unbelievers and groups of that nature, we have a Stoics group in town, all of those are meetup groups, right? They don't have a physical location. But also another interesting thing about those folks is that they belong to multiple philosophical religious organizations. So you may have three meetup groups you go to, and then you're going to go to a bricks and mortar place as well. And I think that's an important thing for us to remember for the future. The atheists are going to get together on Wednesday night and have pizza and beer somewhere, and that's part of what they do. But they also want to do something else about, for example, social justice, which we have a great social justice program. So how do you do that from that mindset? You know, so that's one of the things we're doing, and we're gathering those people into the building to expand the reach of humanism and its varieties. So we are growing.
David, what is your attendance like on an average week or during the week, or how many would you say are members of your congregation? Do you call it a congregation?
We call it a congregation, yes, but you know there are some rhetorical linguistic modes you get into that you can't help saying church. I you know that's just one of those. Just sometimes it happens. We have 465 adult members here. And on any given Sunday, somewhere between 200 and 225 show up. So we average right at 200. And then, you know, we have a lot of people downstairs volunteering to teach and that kind of thing, but in our actual assembly on Sunday morning. So one of the things we keep talking about is how are we going to invent a humanist hell to scare that other half of the members to come every Sunday? We haven't come up with that yet. But.
And tithe.
Well, yes, there is that too. Yeah. That's we definitely have the liberal tithe that goes to the Sierra Club, perhaps more than us sometimes. And we try to say, yeah, but we're the ones who's going to come visit you in the hospital, right? So, but it's a problem.
So, from your perspective, what is Unitarian Universalism? I'm not deliberately trying to be provocative, but like since you used the term religion, that your Sundays are religion neutral, and right now this is something a lot of people are really discussing. Are we a movement? Are we a religion? You know, what's your answer?
Well, I think both Unitarian Universalism and humanism are movements, in that the ideas exist in a lot of different places. And in one way, we just need to be here to be that catalyst for other people. For me, I think that humanism is one of the futures of Unitarian Universalism as time goes by. My argument there is that, you know, I have a huge Methodist church right across the street from this congregation. They're four times as large as we are. I also know that they are becoming more and more Unitarian Universalist in every way you can imagine. So as the number of warm bodies who want to be Christian drop, those people like the liberal Presbyterians in town, the liberal Methodists, they're going to do better and better at gathering in the Christians. I mean, one of the churches in town here says, come on Sunday morning, it's not as bad as you think. So so they're getting really smart. And they also have a rock band and recording studio. So you know they're going to get more and more creative, and so I don't see us as having a strong future in Christianity itself, but we have to remain non-creedal, I believe, because some people want to stay within certain religious positions. In the 1920s, when this place was overtly humanist and it was a brand new idea, they invented the term humanist plus, and because you know atheists have spouses. And how are we going to have a congregation in which everyone feels comfortable? So you could be a humanist plus, you know, plus Christian, plus Buddhist, whatever. And we still practice that.
Right. Well, and I think that our, you know, for how long have we tried to make this spectrum between God and atheism? And mm-hmm. I love what Bob Hill said one time, which is, the real thing that people are facing is a spectrum where fundamentalism is on one end and empty, yeah, rampant consumerism is on the other. And
exactly.
Where do we fall in that?
Right, right, exactly. And the humanists and the Unitarian Universalists are exactly the same in our commitments to fixing the world.
And a piece that I think that drew me to Unitarian Universalism and why I didn't stick with just an AHA chapter or another sort of secular humanist group, and what I've talked with a lot of people around my ages, is we're looking for depth too. And I think that that's something that you need a strong history, and not that humanism doesn't have a strong history, but you need the storyteller to hold that history. And that's what our ministers often act as in our congregations, is they're the ones that bring forward the past. So I think that really the piece that Unitarian Universalism has, that many, this isn't true across the board, but that many humanist organizations don't have, is a heritage. And there's a history there. There are roots there for people to be like, this might be that our ministers and our religious educators are sharing our history with people and telling that story again and again to each new person, because I think that the majority of our people, our come-inners, have transitioned in from another tradition, and then they don't go through our entire Sunday school program or our entire religious education program. They just, it's this idea that where they learn their history is often on Sunday mornings, and maybe in other different small group settings, but I'd say the biggest way is that they pick it up from up there, that message that's happening consistently. And I think that that's the piece that people, while they might be jumping around from meetup group to meetup group, kind of building their own set of communities or their own set of things that they need, the thing that they're looking for, though, in a place like this that other places aren't offering, is consistency and this idea that we're sharing a story that's been going on for a very long time. You know, we're sharing a story that's been going on since, you know, before the 80s, you know, for over 100 years, for several thousand years. You know, like, we're part of that history, even if we're a different iteration of it. We're definitely a Protestant humanist congregation here, right, even though we don't often throw around the word Protestant. But we come out of something, right? There's a reason why we have pews and an organ and meet on Sunday morning. You know, there's the hymns that we sing. Well, some of the words might be different. Came from somewhere. Yeah.
Susan Smith, who is a UU minister, used to be the Southern Region's district executive, said something that, as someone who was raised UU, was kind of the light bulb for me, which is, faith development happens through repetition, not through novelty.
That's a very, very, very good point. I mean, you know, I think that I keep telling the story of this congregation to this congregation because I think it's very, very important. John Dietrich came here, and the people who called him are responsible for humanism really becoming congregational humanism, religious humanism. Because, I mean, if he hadn't been called by a Unitarian group, I mean, he would have just been out in the cold, unemployed, and become a college professor or something. I don't know. But it was the people in this congregation who chose a guy who had been defrocked, right, from one tradition, tried for heresy, and then called himself a humanist, and they said, sure, that's exactly what we want around here, is this heretic. You know, and down in Des Moines, Iowa, his beer-drinking buddy and confederate in humanism was Curtis Reese. And they were both Unitarian ministers, and they were both men who had been ordained in other traditions. And left them because of their conscience. They had to have their integrity, and they came here. And, you know, Curtis Reese became the first president of the American Humanist Association. So this area in the Midwest is really the cradle of humanism, and I think in many ways it reflects a Midwestern attitude in ways that it never has caught on as well on the East or West Coast. So.
One of the things I kind of learned at hanging around the Ann Arbor congregation this last 3 years is it just opened my mind to the to the central role that this Midwest humanism plays in Unitarian Universalist history. That coming from New England and serving in Worcester, I had this vision of our heritage, which was, you know, the story that we tell about the Puritans and the Unitarian controversy and the town churches and the town green, the churches and the town green, and that whole history as being our history. And there's this other whole branch that comes mm-hmm. out of the Midwest that's the humanist history that in many ways is as influential and as formative to the way we do things as this other, even though it's older, history on that side. One of the things that's striking me as you're listening here is, as I'm listening to you guys, is and you use the phrase congregational humanism, and out of all, are there, I mean, aside from the ethical culture folks, are other humanist, atheist organizations like Sunday Assemblies building congregations? And what a difference that makes, because congregational worship, whatever you want to, however you want to define that, you know, is the ritual of Unitarian Universalism, right? And it's a holistic thing. It, you know, it baptizes your baby and it buries your grandmother and it does everything in between. And almost all other organizations, other than religious congregations, only take little slices out of life, right? They're something you belong to in your 20s, or they're something you talk about in your 70s, but they're not the full spectrum. So, you know, the fact that you have a congregational history.
I have another question. I want to jump in real quick. The term religion means different things to different people. When Reverend Breeden says we leave religion out of it, I'm curious what is being left out.
The language or the God symbol, I would say, is the basic thing we leave out. We don't really know what to make of that, and so we just leave it out. But in terms of singing together, in terms certainly of pastoral care, you know, to sort of mix that with Tom's question, last week I was called to testify before the State Senate about a death with dignity bill. Now, that room was full of agnostics and atheists and humanists, but I was the one wearing a priest collar and speaking. Because I'm Unitarian Universalist, and we're in the what I call the religion game, you know, they know that we're in the religion biz. The humanists are not being asked to speak. They don't have a professional clergy, and so how do they even get seen in that landscape? But people know that we are on this side. The same is true in gay marriage. We're on this side, and we're in the religion business, and we're going to show up in collars, you know. And then you've got our anti over there in the same business with their voices, so we're able to balance those voices out. Atheists have simply left the game, right? And so they don't figure into this conversation, unfortunately, maybe, but that's just the case.
And something that I would say about kind of what we mean by religion, or what I mean by religion at this place and for Unitarian Universalism more broadly, is that I describe myself as religious but not spiritual, to switch the spiritual but not religious on its head. And for me, what that means is that I'm community focused, right? By being a congregational humanist, what to me worship and religious tradition is about coming together as a community, an intentional community that's setting about to do something. You know, it's not just an accidental, a happenstance community. Like, this place exists for a purpose or many purposes, but that we come together for something, instead of just we happen to be in the same room together.
Right, right. And you know, I love Tom's writing, by the way, Tom. Let me give you a shout-out for your good writing. And, you know, one of the things that you've written about that I think is great is about social engagement among Unitarians and Universalists over time. This congregation has always been very, very progressive. John Dietrich, 1 year after he arrived, was a pacifist in the First World War. Now, if you stop and think about it, they were hanging people from lampposts for being pacifists in the First World War. So that's pretty radical. You know, we formed a credit union during the Great Depression to help people borrow money. That, you know, we've always, and we also happen to have a a communist theater group during that time, you know, and those kinds of things. One of our ministers in the 40s and 50s, Carl Storm, wrote his dissertation on Marxism. He was clearly a Marxist and was accepted as that during the 1950s, which is scary. You know, we've always stuck to that left side, and one of the reasons for that, I think, is that humanism is dedicated to progressivism, always, because we don't have any scriptures to tie us down. So when a good progressive idea comes up, we're already there, you know. So.
And Asia, I see we have another viewer question.
Apparently not.
Another one, because I just read the ones that I could see.
Okay.
Got it. I have a question. Good. In our last minute.
And you're a viewer. Come on.
Mm-hmm. at the Society, do y'all talk about covenant? Covenant is something that so many UU churches are talking yep. about. You know, we're yes. bound together, not by creed, by covenant. Is that a word?
Yes. Oh, yes, we have a staff covenant, we have a covenant among our members. We do that good, grand, old UU covenant every week. Love is the spirit of this church. Yeah, but, you know, we do that every week. We talk about that quite a bit. Again, because being outside what we see as hierarchy, Bob Dylan said it best: to be outside the law, you must be honest, right? So we have to have covenant because we don't agree with most hierarchical systems. So. I should point out, by the way, behind me is our logo, and that kind of is, if you can see that, that kind of is us. It's based on the tree of life that was a symbol for many years here, with the colors of the leaves saying, you know, we're with you all from cradle to grave. But also you'll see that the chalice is in our logo. And that's kind of how we feel about it, is that Unitarian Universalism is part of us, but it's not all of us. So kind of graphic there.
Well, that reminds me kind of some of the old New England churches that were themselves long before merger, and in fact in many cases long before the AUA itself, and so Unitarianism and Unitarian Universalism is a current garment, not the body, I just come up with that kind of stuff.
Hey, brilliant.
But anyway, I got a
question. If in the last bit, What do you mean by non-hierarchical? What are you referring when you say that?
The Humanist Manifestos and the Amsterdam Agreement, which is a European form of that, all say that we must break down all hierarchical systems. That would include patriarchy. It certainly includes white privilege. We have to break those down, and we have to be a place where no oppression exists. And many of us find Christianity to have been an oppressive force in society and on our own lives. So we really believe that we are a place that fights all hierarchical systems. Now that's aspirational, but
and to Tom's point about the idea of Unitarian Universalism being a garment, I really like that analogy, because I think for this congregation, it might have been a more active conversation over time, but we are recommitting to be Unitarian Universalists on a regular basis, annually, when we say we're doing this. You know, it might not be that it comes up as a question posed on the floor every year, but we've consistently over time said, yes, still, we're Unitarian Universalists. As we've moved to be more and more humanist, it's an and we're Unitarian Universalists always. You know, but the idea is that it's always a question, I think, which is really important.
Yeah. One of our catchphrases is we are a safe place for dangerous ideas. And we mean all dangerous ideas.
Speaking of dangerous ideas, we're going to have, we're coming to the end of our program here today. And thank you to David and Kevin for speaking with us today, telling us about First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis and the Humanist Institute. Next week, we have our two candidates for president of the UUA with us, Reverend Allison Miller and Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. And so that we're looking forward to that as a great hour, and it will be recorded and available on YouTube afterwards. I know many people are anxious to get to see these candidates more up close and in a more relaxed setting than just Facebook pages, et cetera, if they don't know them yet. So we invite you all to come back and meet the candidates. I imagine we'll do this many more times in the long campaign that lies ahead. Right? So we look forward to hosting them and having all of you with us as well. So thanks, and that's it for The View this week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.